Okay, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah. So, okay, so I've given, you know, various versions of this talk, and the version I propose to give now focuses less on technical details and giving the many results that we and others have gotten over the past couple of years, and more on just the general ideology and what I see as the important open questions, which there are obviously many. This subject, I think, has just barely begun. And so I'll start off by kind of summarizing this problem, and then proceed to some of the simplest examples, very sketchy. I understand that Frederick Deneff will talk on Thursday, and he'll give you, I think, a more concrete example of the types of techniques we use to do this vacuum counting. And then, if there's time, I'll get into various general comments about what you would do with this stuff, how you might be able to make predictions, how possible selection mechanisms for vacua could be used in this framework. And it's mostly going to be, again, very, very incomplete summary of points that people have made over the past 20, 30 years about this problem from the point of view of quantum cosmology, and then some minimal, so far, additional input from string theory. Okay, so and by all means, you know, by virtue of this type of talk, the point is to interrupt me if something is not seem clear or justified, or, you know, if there's some other point of view. So there should be many interruptions. Okay, so the type of problem that I think is you know, central for direct attempts to do string phenomenology and try to confront and, you know, real-world data and perhaps falsify the theory is this vacuum selection problem that for a very long time, you know, even the first quasi-realistic constructions, there were many Calabi-Yaus and many choices, and no a priori principle that told you which of these choices might agree with the real world. And our great successes in developing the formal structure of the theory and seeing these dualities, to a large extent so far, have only made this problem worse. Now, a few years ago, I guess, a turning point came where the problem got so bad that in some sense it got better. And this was the work of Busel and Polchinski, who made concrete those earlier proposals of Weinberg and others that said that if you have enough vacua that could agree with all the other data and produce a range of values for the cosmological constant, then you could solve the cosmological constant problem. And the combination of these arguments with the real evidence for a non-zero cosmological constant, I think, is the strongest reason to believe that the problem of counting vacua and searching through them for the possibilities is not just a artifact of our incomplete understanding of the theory, but that there is no a priori, uniquely determined vacua, either by the internal structure of the theory or by initial conditions, but there has to be some ingredient of searching through possibilities to find ones that fulfill sort of external, some people would say environmental, criteria. Yeah, but again, I you know, some people see this as a very kind of revolutionary step, and I tend not to think so myself. I tend to say that this is just the way all other known physical theories tend to work. They just have many solutions. Before you can make a really detailed confrontation with data, you have to have some idea what the solutions are and sort through them and decide, well, given the system a hand, you know, which solution might be a candidate to describe it. Now we make our tests, and the only difference being that we only have the one solution to observe in this case, but that's not a difference from this larger point of view. Okay, so could we imagine it making some sort of picture of the set of possible vacuum string theory that we could now sort through and compare with data? Well, obviously the first question is, do we know what a vacuum is? And, you know, do we control it precisely enough to study this sort of thing? And the strict answer, of course, is no. You know, we have very limited, precise formulations of the theory. At the best case would be, say, something that is ADS with a lot of supersymmetry, so it's not a candidate to describe the real world. But you can make a lot of progress by granting what a lot of previous work granted without discussion, and if you look back at that work, its internal self-consistency, to the extent you believe it is so, seems to support this hypothesis that there is a microscopic picture, which, you know, in some limits is a 10-dimensional field theory. In some limits, it's the 4-dimensional effective field theory, which you would get by Kaluza-Klein reduction, plus adding certain non-perturbative corrections to the potential. In principle, you could sum up all correction, quantum corrections to this original 10-dimensional description and get some sort of exact 4-dimensional effective field theory, which was claimed to describe some, you know, limited, you know, set of the space of possibilities, but within that subset, you know, given its assumptions as to which fields are light and so forth, would be exact. And then within effective field theory, the definition of a vacuum is clear. It's a minimum of the effective potential. So there's some set of finite set of fields and exact effective potential in principle that would describe some little region of this configuration space, and the vacuum counting problem reduces to either computing or at least controlling, you know, getting some sort of controlled expression for these things and then finding vacuum in the standard sense of effective field theory. And this point of view, of course, is, you know, both not proven and gets interesting criticisms. Certainly the reference for these criticisms is the work of Tom Banks. And to my mind, there's not any compelling criticism. And on the other hand, there are criticisms which are, you know, interesting and certainly deserve to be thought about and might turn out to have some validity. And perhaps the most interesting one, okay, so again, you know, to the extent you have any kind of clear microscopic description of the theory, you know, some sort of string field theory, then this is all justified in the standard way you do in field theory. You throw out an infinite number of degrees of freedom to focus on the small number which are relevant, you know, which might be massless or tachyonic in a given situation, and integrate all the rest out. And all that logic seems perfectly reasonable, and although you might now ask, well, we didn't have a viable theory of quantum gravity before. Well, how do we know it works in quantum gravity? How do we know it doesn't work? Now, there is no a priori argument within quantum gravity that to describe spacetimes that are roughly semi-classical and in which the physics really does look kind of like effective field theory, the standard model at sufficiently, you know, intermediate energies where it's a field theory, you know, and so forth. There's no obvious argument that this is false. Now, an example of the sort of thing you might worry about, okay, so this is metastability, okay, so we have this effective potential as various potential wells. You know, we might imagine that if there's a low energy one, it will decay. Okay, so this we know from observation that the vacuum energy reserve is this tiny positive number. And there's only been many guys with different values of the vacuum energy. And the description of these tunneling events is different in quantum gravity in ways you can already see semi-classically because the geometry changes. There are interesting cases where decays are forbidden and so forth. So one needs to take that into account. You know, it's not a quantum effective field theory without gravity. But suppose you do, you can calculate what you think are the various decay rates to these things. That would be the next consistency condition after this one. And suppose there's a decay mode, you know, some possible bubble of something, some other vacuum appears on an average time scale of, you know, 1 year. Well, obviously, that would be a serious problem for the claim that this describes our universe. You know, it would be violently unstable on cosmological time scales. Okay, and so that would be another condition in the same spirit as the ones I'm adding here. Okay, there are many other things which all fit into this paradigm, which in principle you have to check. So another common argument people give for or against effective field theory in some situation is to say, well, don't you need the fields here to be all it's much lighter than the degrees of freedom that you integrated out, you know, the Kaluza-Klein modes, the Strini modes, and so forth and so forth. And strictly speaking, the correct answer is no, you don't need that. What you just need is you need to be able to argue that all the other modes stay heavy in this situation. That argument is much easier if you can first focus on some subspace of light modes and talk about corrections and so forth and be guaranteed that none of those corrections will bring down Kaluza-Klein modes. If you don't have that, it could be that you've missed some mode that comes down and became tachyonic, but you just dropped it, so you didn't properly derive the effective field theory. But that's not a problem in principle. That's a problem in your derivation of the effective field theory. I guess there's a list of such things, of which this fast decay is an example. Now, suppose you find another decay of this sort for which the expected time scale of the decay is 10 to the 100 years. Okay, well, from some sort of phenomenological or pragmatic point of view, you would say, well, you know, who cares? You know, we're not going to be around in 10 to 100 years. There might well be such decays. You know, we have no evidence. But it could be, of course, that string theory provides no resolution of the possible, you know, endpoint of such a decay. So if you look semi-classically at such decays to ADS, they typically create not an expanding bubble of the new vacuum within the old vacuum, but some sort of a big crunch space-time, which is guaranteed to go singular at the point of tunneling. Okay, so now, suppose that singularity has no sensible description in string theory, then you might be tempted to argue that, well, even if it only happens after 10 to 100 years, it is a theoretical inconsistency which prevents considering this vacuum. And that's the type of possibility that Banks raises. Now, of course, there are other possibilities you might maintain, such as string theory does provide some way of describing the evolution after this. This is not some a priori inconsistency in dissolution. It's just a physical effect that if you were interested in timescales of 10 to the 100 years, you would have to worry about, but for timescales of 10 to the 10 years, you do not. And so to my mind, the arguments of this sort that I know have that flavor. You know, they're not crazy, but from some pragmatic point of view, you know, they're not obviously problems, and so we proceed. Okay, so now the question becomes a more technical one. Can we really do these calculations to the precision that we require to make interesting statements about the existence and number of vacua? And I think, obviously, our ability is still limited, but we're making sufficiently rapid progress to make these questions worth considering now. You know, we can, in very limited, you know, regimes of somewhat large coupling, some volume, weak coupling, and so forth, get controlled results, and we should start thinking about what to do with such things. Okay, if this were another talk, I might discuss, you know, detailed work on making KKLT type of constructions, justifying them, showing that they're controlled. But for this talk, I'm just going to assume that such things can make sense, and we can start to think about them. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about this. If somebody, again, wants to, you know, discuss further, we can come back to. Okay, so now, what are the general features? Okay, so believing that there are these, you know, quasi-realistic vacua, I think it really is essential to get, you know, some sort of very, very, very rough characterization of what does this set of vacua look like that we are sorting through. And the basic problem being that, you know, what is the traditional or, you know, approach to string phenomenology. The goal is to construct one example that agrees with the, you know, standard model and the other observational evidence. And then whatever properties that example reveals, you know, beyond that we might consider predictions of the theory. And of course, a little thinking, you know, in analogous cases where you know the answer, shows that this is potentially very naive. You know, so the obvious counterexample is if you have another theory of quantum gravity which allows coupling fairly general forms of matter with no constraints. Okay, when, you know, to the extent that you know that, of course, just showing that there exists a, you know, theory coupled to the standard model with, you know, alpha QED equals 1/137, you know, maybe you postulate grand unification, is in itself no evidence, you know, that your theory likes those things, because you could have just as easily postulated 1/138 and so forth. And you have to know about the alternatives to the thing that you've discovered to have any sense of how significant it is. And, of course, in the extreme case, what's the extreme case of lack of predictability? It would be that by making some sort of choice in the original Clavier, you know, 10 or 11 dimensions, you could get at any effective field theory you wanted. You know, coupled to gravity with some gauge vector, some value of the couplings, okay, and then string theory would be no more predictive in that sense than this general class of four-dimensional effective theories. So to really test the theory, you would have to hope that you either discover something which doesn't fit into, well, basically something that doesn't fit into four-dimensional effective field theory, either in the negative sense that string theory can't describe it either, and you can come up with such examples, or, you know, in some positive sense that you really see extra dimensions or light black holes or some other very novel phenomenon. Okay, so you could always imagine your hope that, you know, we'll test string theory in that way, but to the extent that the physics really looks like four-dimensional effective field theory, the testability depends on the claim that not all four-dimensional effective field theories can come out of string theory. Okay, so now it's really not easy to choose a given effective field theory and decide whether it can come out of string theory or not. So the standard model was not an easy case. Even simpler models with smaller gauge groups and so forth are not easy cases. It's worth making the direct approach. But a indirect approach, which also sheds light on this question, is just to try to, again, describe this population of all the vacua, which look anything at all like the real world, and answer basic questions like, well, is the number finite or infinite? You know, if so, you know, very, very crudely estimate this number. Is this distribution peaked in any sense around interesting, you know, observables, or is it very uniform? As you think about this question, you realize that, well, you know, what does a uniform distribution mean? You know, we have, you know, we can have any, you know, SUN gauge group in principle. You know, what is the uniform distribution on SUN gauge groups? You know, is it equal number for every N, or probably not, because there has to be some cutoff for some large N. You know, is there a power law falling in N, or an exponential falling in N? So, you know, is there some natural uniform distribution for these questions? Coupling constants too. You know, it's potential. You know, you can say, you know, they're distributed d lambda, but that's probably naive. You know, why the variable lambda, you know, for some given coupling and not lambda squared or something else? Okay, so that's sort of the most basic questions about what are the general features of this distribution of vacua. You know, to make it more precise, you would look at this question in a given, you know, set of constructions, you know, some given class, some given set of compact spaces and other choices, and make the list, you know, in some theoretical sense of the resulting four-dimensional effective field theories, and then you could look at the whole distribution of quantities in that effective field theory and get a distribution function, something which is a measure which will write, you know, gauge group, cosmological constant, couplings, and so forth, is a sum of delta functions over all the candidate vacua of, you know, g minus gi, lambda minus lambda I, little lambda minus little lambda I, and so forth. And so if you could somehow characterize this distribution function and the spaces on which it lives, you know, so these guys, well, again, from the effective field theory point of view, there is a space, you know, whether that's the most natural to think about is less clear, but in any case, you could integrate this over that space and try to say how many theories there are. Okay, so what does one expect to come out? Well, I'm going to get to examples. You know, I mean, one can try to throw out various, you know, guesses. You know, for these, people have thought more about these continuous parameters. You know, there was a existing argument that distribution of cosmological constants should be expected to be pretty uniform near lambda equals zero on over energy scales less than all the other scales in the theory, you know, like m sub z to the 4 and the other sorts of vacuum energies and so forth. And this argument, which, you know, again goes back to this, you know, Weinberg et al. Type of work, is just that lambda is a sum of many different contributions to the vacuum energy from different sectors of the theory. You know, from various quantum, potentially, you know, classical, non-perturbative corrections. And there's nothing a priori that correlates contributions from different sectors of the theory. They come in with different signs. Once you start adding sufficiently complicated combinations of variables with any reasonable distribution, and you add enough of them, you produce normal distributions, but normal distributions with a scale set by the original natural scalar variation of the problem. So presumably m sub z to the fourth. We don't see any, you know, influence of lower scales within the effective field theory framework. And so down at the scales of interest for the cosmological constant problem is going to be pretty uniform. Because that's the type of argument that one gets from, you know, very, very general considerations of effective field theory, insofar as we can tell, also valid within string theory. Okay, well, what might one expect for couplings? Okay, well, you know, again, you might think that there's some natural definition of coupling which things are uniform. Alternatively, it might be that things are highly peaked. And, you know, this type of peaking, of course, is not crazy either. You know, if you know, we know many statistical problems where you add variables, and again, you get normal distributions which are peaked around the mean, and they, as you add more and more variables, the spread is only, you know, square root of n. So in some sense, it peaks more and more sharply. And you might try to hypothesize things like, well, in the class of theories that give rise to guts, you know, maybe the mean unified coupling peaks at 1 over 25, and we'll get some explanation of the value of the coupling. You know, you choose your favorite feature of the standard model. Now, again, you stare at this, you know, with any experience of string compactification, you, at least most people agree when I say, well, this looks, you know, very naively optimistic. You know, what is it in string theory that likes 1 over 25? You know, the original definition of the problem doesn't seem to pick out anything special about this aspect of the theory. You know, but you can't dismiss it out of hand, and it is pretty, as I say, also generic in these problems to get peaking. So that's the basic type of question. Of course, there are correlations between the observables and so forth, which are, you know, you have one has less of an intuitive feeling about whether it's there or not. And so they're worth looking for. Okay, so finally, to kind of, you know, give this kind of question of general features, well, here, I mean, I before concluding this, I mean, this question of the uniform distribution comes along with another one of the question of, are there kind of particularly natural and simple distributions, things which we might expect to come out of many, you know, string theory in many given situations, you know, natural classes of field theory. So that's clearly a thing that one should search for, and I'll be able to give you examples. Okay, so finally, this question of numbers, as I'll say more in theory, bears on this question of to what extent you require mechanisms to solve the problems of particle physics versus the extent that things could happen purely statistically. Okay, this guy probably belongs in the discussion under three, so I'll postpone it for that. Okay, so having, you know, thrown out these questions about this really very difficult to characterize and work with hypothetical distribution of all the string vacua, well, how does one actually work on that? Well, the hope, okay, I'll talk about specific examples in a moment, and obviously the hope is that this thing is not impossibly complicated, but that by working around the various control regimes that we could hope to access, that's obviously the starting point. You know, we have 2D, F theory, heterotic, 2A, M theory, different heterotic, and so forth. And we can make various constructions. We can start with 2B and a Calabi-L, consider different ways of adding brains, putting bundles on those, and flux, and so forth, and find the different vacua of each theory in a sense, and kind of start populating, you know, find out what this distribution looks like in this controlled regime. Okay, that gets us out to some distance, you know, still probably weak coupling. And the hope for going beyond this clearly has to be now to borrow from or to follow the same steps that were so successful in talking about extended supersymmetry theories of hypothesizing extrapolations, in that case of the moduli space. One had real moduli spaces of vacua. One could just say, well, as I go off to strong coupling, that's a modulus. I believe it turns into this dual theory at Y. You know, X is connected to Y, and I postulate some bigger connected moduli space of theories. And the hope basically here has to be the same, just that we've replaced the idea of moduli space with these distributions of observables gotten by summing over points in this configuration space, so that we get distributions, let's say, in 2B and 2A, we know enough about these, you know, M as well, to say that these distributions look kind of different within the controlled regime, but different for fairly clear reasons that we haven't taken into account all the choices. Up here, we didn't include all the choices you could easily make down here, vice versa. Maybe we can postulate some bigger ensemble of vacua hypothesize some way that the 2A Lagrangian behaves in the limit of, that you could have done the mirror symmetry, large complex structure or large volume, and make a larger connected set of vacua, and then, test it against whatever information we can get from the various regimes. And this the work in this direction is just beginning, but I think, again, the success we've had with duality and the hope that this really is a natural object coming out of string theory, by all rights it should have some sort of simplicities, make this not a crazy hope. Okay, so that's as far as I'll go in this very, very general level of discussion. The main point I want to make, I've pushed all the questions of what do you actually do with this thing, which is much more confusing to think about, down to three. And the main point I want to make is that this is a question with a well-defined answer if string theory is anything like what we believe in now, and we start to have the techniques to work on it. So there is this distribution that we can try to get a handle on through looking at pieces and thinking about what might be general features of this distribution of vacua. Okay, so now the example that's been worked on by far the most is the distribution of flux vacua, fixing the theory, fixing the Calabi-Yau, varying the choice of flux, searching through the moduli space, which is just fixed by flux for vacua, supersymmetric, non-supersymmetric. Let me briefly begin by outlining another problem which has received less work. And in fact, there's only two. There was a little bit of this in my 2003 paper, but Blumen and Haugen et al. More recently have a more detailed paper covering a case of a toroidal manifold, talking about the statistics of gauge groups coming out of, say, T6 mod Z2 or manifold compactification of the 2B theory. I guess 2A, actually. I mean, you can use both languages, and they actually work in 2A, the concrete. And so what do? Well, you have this. You now have some sort of O6 or manifolding that you choose in some O6 plane, which extends along three real dimensions of this T6. And now you count the various ways that you could add D6 primes that sum up whose total contribution to the O6 tadpole equals the, cancels the O6 tadpole. And so there's, some set of ways of arranging these brains. One has to decide, if one's looking for supersymmetric vacuum, do they all preserve supersymmetry? There's a simple condition on the angles, which you can make here. One has to decide if, all such configurations are distinct, or if there might be other dualities as we vary these moduli. But eventually one gets down to some list of distinct brain configurations. Properly speaking, one should then look at the possibility.
Can you repeat that sentence you just said about the angles?
So there's a, so if you ask for counting supersymmetric vacua, the condition that this set of brains will preserve supersymmetry is basically the condition that if you look at the SO6 rotation that carries the original O6 plane into one of these three real dimensional planes, you diagonalize and you get three angles of rotation and they have to add up to zero. In other words, it really has to live in SU3, the rotation. And then that's necessary and sufficient. And so you list brain configurations satisfying this. And then, again, the first question that might come to hand is, well, is it really a finite list of these brain configurations, or are there series that just run off to infinity, where you add more and more brains of different types? They're always supersymmetric. At first, there's some positivity in this condition. And in simpler versions of this problem like T2, it's clear. But once you get up to T6, and especially once you get down into the stringy regime, so the real condition here, this is a a linearized approximation to what actually allows for more somewhat more interesting behavior as the size of the torus becomes smaller. There's dependence on R, which
can
I have.
To begin with.
Well, you could sum over that too. You would like to. I believe Blumenhagen fixed this one. Blumenhagen et al. And so even this positivity is not obvious from the start of the problem, but one can list. And their main techniques are A, computer enumeration of this type of constraint, but B, a very simple argument, which is just that the basic model for this, suppose you've got the list of possible individual brains of this type, okay, so they're bound states, but by individual brain I mean something that carries a U1 gauge group, so not two copies of a same brain, but something which is simple in this mathematical sense. Okay, well then, basically what you're doing is you're partitioning this charge number among the possible candidate simple brains, possibly with repetitions. And so you might expect that the basic structure or the asymptotic of this problem, that this charge becomes large, is like the asymptotics of numbers of just partitions of an integer. So if we call this number L, you might expect the number of such configurations to go as e to the square root of L with computable factor there. And then there are standard saddle point techniques for doing that type of combinatorics. And they do this and get fairly good agreement with direct numerical search for these lines.
And is large enough for them there?
Yeah. So that's right. So the L here is 32. And that's right. You can't answer all questions this way, but for a basic estimate like this, yes. So that would be one model for this. You know, there are total charges which characterize the configuration. These are basically, this can be basically fairly directly dualed. It's not, the details are not all well understood, but it's mirror to bundles on the Miracle-Abia, in this case, still a torus. And what one's doing is one's enumerating bundles with specified C2. Okay, so in fact, bundles with some reality condition, or SO, or SP structure group. But it's much like the problem of enumerating bundles of a specified rank, let's say C1 equals 0, and bound on C2, or a specified C2. And so here, if you were looking at this problem, the first question that would present itself is that, well, there's another topological invariant, C3. So even if we grant that within a given topological type, somehow there's a finite number of vacua, how do we know that the range of C3s are bounded? And you have to bring in the stability condition. If you just talk about general holomorphic bundles, it's not true. If you ask about mu stable bundles, it turns out that this is bounded, but it's actually not a trivial thing. There's a theorem of Maruyama originally, and Langer has written about this more recently. So there is some absolute bound, depending on the other invariants, on C3. And that's the type of result to compare with here. L is analogous to C2. This is a more general stability condition, and one's allowing certain singularities. But that's another very related class of problems where one has this type of boundedness.
So may I understand that even if the sum of all possible O6, the configurations are finite?
Well, the list of O6 hasn't been... the cases where people have listed the O6s, I think in the torus it has to be trivial. I actually don't know the answer, but the one which I'm going to throw out.
Number of O6 is L and L.
Yeah, that's right. For any given orientifold, you derive L. Okay, so once you choose this plane, it's just something you make from topological invariants associated with this plane. So in the T-dual case, it's this L, L, the number that appears in the signature, in this formula for the signature. And it's just a topological term by its choice. And now, the cases where people tried to systematically classify this, I'm sure it's been done for the torus, but the case that comes to mind is Brenner, Horry et al. For the Gepner models of the quintic and the another Glavial. You find that it is finite, the list of possible orientifolding choices. So indeed, that would be another ingredient in the full problem. This is all still pieces of the full problem. Okay, so this is a estimated number of vacua or asymptotics for this type of problem. And now you could ask questions like, well, what is the distribution of the ranks of the gauge groups? So let's just take a given, what's the fraction of models that contain SUN for some given n? Well, Well, they talk certainly about the guy that just goes along, the obvious, real parts of every complex, two torus. And Yeah. I mean, I think if you talk about a flat one, that's just a choice of basis, right? I mean, there might be some more sophisticated oriented folding, but you
is
could.
Is there any? What else is there?
I don't know of another one offhand, but now people are asking me, is it proven that there's another one? And in the governor context, you can sort of prove it. You know, you have explicit boundary states to play with. Again, it's sort of assuming rationality. No, I'm certainly not going to claim that it's proven that this choice is finite. In almost no case will I claim that it's proven that the choice is finite. The most I will say is that people did a search, you know, in some big class of possibilities, and it was finite. So how do you get this in this discussion? Well, of course, in terms of bundles, this would have to be an endomorphism group. Here it comes from taking n copies of the same elementary brain. You know, so if this is one of them, if you take n copies running along the, you know, embedded in the same three cycle, you would get SUN gauge symmetry. And in this language, what it basically amounts to is you make partitions and you ask that you repeat. You use the same integer in the partition n times. Okay, and then following through again the standard analysis of partitions, the typical partition in some sense has square root of L different entries. And there can be pieces where this goes up to the square root of L, roughly copies of the same thing. So if you go through and compute what is the number of partitions that contain a given L or L copies of the same things, where we let that number be this. This has a asymptotic which falls off exponentially on the scale square root of L. Okay, and so that's a answer. And again, you know, within this class of problems, precise to the question of what's a natural distribution for this G. So of course, again, to get the full distribution, you should sum over the possibilities here and sum over the L's, but already at this level, based on considerations of examples, this L ranges between 10 and a few hundred, maybe already 1,000 here. And so gauge groups can easily get up to order 10, 30, and it's likely to get roughly 10, 30 of those gauge groups, and then getting many more gauge groups or getting much larger gauge groups is disfavored. And that's why. So that's a relatively simple picture of the distribution, which, again, might or might not survive generalizing to larger sets of vacua, but its simplicity is appealing. Now, physically, what might you do with this? Just very vaguely. One of the questions where you have really no direct observational input is the basic nature of the dark matter, and other possible hidden sectors. So we know there's some dark matter. We haven't detected that particle directly. It might be part of the supersymmetric extension of the standard model. It might not. Okay, well, string theory very generically allows extra hidden sectors that do not talk through gauge interactions to the standard model, starting with the original E8 cross E8 heterotic string. So there's a certain way of possibility which has been out there for a long time. And now one might ask, well, out of these many gauge sectors, what is the distribution of matter? To what extent are there hidden sectors? So this would be an example of a sector with charged matter, say F21, N1, N2, matter of the N1, N2 bar, which talk to each other, have interactions through this charged matter under both gauge groups. You might have other sectors without such matter, which are hidden from the point of view of this one. So perhaps the primary question I should have said before getting into this that you would like to ask is, let me again anticipate a bit. This is a bit of an artificial, there's definitely a reason to insist on this distinction, but of course it's useful to say these things. Okay, so what would the, you can ask, out of the whole, this hypothetical large population of all string vacua, how hard is it to get the standard model? What fraction of these guys should we expect to get the standard model? And on a very rough level, you could decompose that problem into these parts. You got to get the matter content of the standard model, the gauge groups. You got to get the cosmological constant. You got to get all the other couplings. And, of course, the Higgs boson. Okay, so this part, if you grant this kind of uniform distribution over a range all the way to the Planck scale, you can say something precise. Just statistically, a fraction of 10 to 122 vacua with uniformly distributed cosmological constant would match the presumably observed value. Okay, because we don't literally prove that it's cosmological constant yet, but let's grant that. Okay, now you can make a similar exercise and say all the other couplings of the standard model, the other 19 parameters, are uniformly distributed, and we know that they're measured to a certain accuracy. You multiply together all those accuracies to get a volume and coupling space, like the fine structure constant is measured to 10 places, the mass of the proton is measured to 10 places, and that's a complicated function of the QCD parameters and so forth, but you could use that to substitute for one of those more fundamental gods.
But measurement is not a fundamental statement.
I agree. This is characterizing the level of matching the standard model as we understand it now. That's right. That's why I was originally postponing it to here, but I'm going to match on to what I said there in a moment. Of course, it might be that we discover supersymmetry, and the problem becomes matching that. I'm just characterizing what we know now. So you multiply together these 19 parameters, and they come out to be a little generous in the accuracies of the same order, 10 to the minus 120. And so you might say, well, just given a totally random population of models here, if we have fewer than 10 to 240 models that get the right Nader spectrum, then it's surprising if we reproduce the standard model, the structure there. Whereas if there are many more than 10 to 240, it's not that surprising that one of them matched the standard model. Okay, and so now to complete the argument, you need to say something about this. What fraction of this whole set of gauge groups matches the standard model, gauge group and matter content? And much, much looser arguments of the character that I discussed here suggest, this was in my 2003 paper, that this is much easier. This is in the 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 20 range. And so that's maybe the primary application of this. And then having said that, you can ask, well, out of those gods, how many hidden sectors? You know, how many of them have one hidden sector, zero hidden sectors, two hidden sectors, and so forth? Okay, so that's one kind of, Okay, so in this framework, it's the intersection number between a pair of ranks. So the topological, you could regard these as topological three cycles, and it's literally that topological intersection number. So you can also, and Blumenhagen is going to study that, and they actually find interesting but complicated correlation between, say, you know, numbers of gauge groups and average ranks here and amount of chiral matter. Okay, of course, it's the chiral, the number of chiral, generations minus anti-generations that you directly control by this topological number. Okay, so that's one illustrative example. And,
So when you calculate this joint distribution function, the lambda G and the little lambda, how do you make sure there's only one peak in this multi three-dimensional parameter space?
Oh, no, I'm not also assuming there's a peak. I mean, the point is to not make any a priori assumptions. So if there's any peak here, it's a zero, but depending on your scale of interest, for the purpose of matching the standard model, this is not sharply peaked. As I said, it starts to fall off for gauge group of order SU10 or 20. So for the purpose of matching the standard model, there's more or less no peaking. That's why this is relatively easy. There's an interesting thing that comes out, which is kind of specific to this construction, which is that the hard part, okay, so you have to, if you really look at, papers that construct a standard model from brains, it is fairly easy, okay, in the sense that usually, people start with a torus or a given, manifold, and they find they can do it. They can construct the supersymmetric standard model, but the hard part is that, very generically, there are other gauge groups, and there is exotic charge matter, which is charge under a standard model, and under the other gauge group. Okay, so what I just said motivates the other gauge groups, and some grants of generosity might lead you to suspect that, well, typically some of these guys intersect and you get extra charge matter. And this is very hard to accommodate phenomenologically, extra chiral charge matter, because it can only get mass from electrical weak symmetry breaking. So it really either is observed or shows up directly in the S&T parameters, which are very well constrained. And so in a sense, this is the hard part. So this is under an assumption that says that what's a natural mechanism to get rid of this matter? Well, you could have clusters of cycles in the dual description. It's much less clear in this, but in the 2B description where these guys are wrapping two cycles and four cycles, you can have clusters of cycles, say, that come from resolving the same singularity that only intersect among themselves and don't intersect anything else. Okay, and that's what makes it easy to get this constraint. If you go to some simpler thing that doesn't assume that and just says that every brain has the same probability to affect every other brain, then this becomes very hard as soon as you get these other gauge groups, and that becomes one of the controlling factors in the problem. You basically predict that the Calabi-Yau should only have four or five different cycles. So that's, again, another very interesting correlation, but within a restricted and probably simplistic set of assumptions. But you can control the charged matter. And the point is not to make any assumptions. The point is just to consider the largest class of models you can, find out whether it's peaked or not. Okay, so now let me say a few words. Again, this I could give a whole other talk on results on flux vacuum. Frederick will, to some extent, substitute for that, but I'm happy to speak again in this workshop on these types of results. So an example of a problem you can consider in this language is the set of 2B flux vacua on a given Calabi-Yau or Anifold. This is probably familiar to most of you by now. So you have two three-form fluxes, the RR, the Nevers-Schwarz flux, and you get a effective Gukov, Boffa, Witten, Taylor type superpotential in the effective supergravity Lagrangian. So you start with the n equals 2 of 2b on Calabi-Yau, and then the effect of adding this flux in this language is just to basically turn on this superpotential. And then if you're a large volume, you can assume that the Taylor potential is the n equals 2 one, so you can compute it, plus small corrections. So this is the standard thing from spectral geometry, and a lot has been computed about these objects. So you can go quite far in listing these vacua and enumerating solutions of this, supersymmetric, even non-supersymmetric. Okay, so this stabilizes deltaic compact structure. There's furthermore this Nappel constraint that effectively puts an upper bound on the flux. And the type of simple result one gets for this problem is first in my work with my student Sujay Ashok, and done much better in my subsequent work with Denef. You can write a formula for the index density. You can also write a formula that counts the actual number of vacua, but let me just define the quantity that I'm computing. So now we want to sum over forces of flux satisfying this constraint. We want to define a density of vacua in this complex structure across dilaton moduli space, which again is just delta function, but delta function that says that we've got a supersymmetric vacuum. So dw z tau equals 0. So we're going to count solutions of dw equals 0, and we want to count them with unit weight. Okay, so if we use the usual physics definition of delta function, we don't get unit weight under the z tau integral. We want something that integrated over some region in z tau space gives us the number of critical points in that region. So given the usual physics definition here, we can compensate the weight by adding a Jacobian factor. Okay, so this is the Jacobian for changing variables back to delta z tau. Okay, so this is the thing I would like to compute, and it's a intricate and complicated sum of delta functions. There's a pretty picture of the simplest case where you take a rigid Calabi-Yau and you only stabilize the dilaton. That's a very easy problem to treat exactly, and there's a pretty plot in my paper with Denef for the solution for a given finite L150. Okay, so a bunch of dots in the upper half plane. We want to count them, of course, mod duality equivalences, so we can do that in this case by restricting to the fundamental region, and there's some finite number of vacua, which as you take the control parameter, I'm going to call this L here, large asymptotes to L squared times the uniform measure, the thing coming from the constant negative curvature metric, or physically just the metric that was the metric of the kinetic term in the supergravity, the SL2R invariant metric. Okay, so we'd like to calculate that more generally, and we have explicit results for this guy in work with Bernie Schiffman and Steve Zaldich. Okay, the trickiness in doing this exactly is this absolute value sign. Okay, but let's suppose we simplify our life by rubbing out this absolute value sign. Okay, so this now is weighing, it's doing the same thing, it's counting vacua, but with a sign plus or minus 1 that comes from the sign of the determinant of what is essentially the fermion mass matrix. Again, the real discussion is a Gravitino that makes this. But, this
but the dynamics might actually prefer this without the absolute value. How do we know? In other words, might be the more natural thing anyhow.
I'm just precisely defining. I didn't get up to number 3 yet, but this guy is by far the simpler one. This is the guy that has the quasi-topological property that as we, in particular, vary the Kähler potential. Okay, so this is, okay, what's the first thing you might have said? This is a problem of counting, critical points of a holomorphic section. It looks kind of like a topological problem. And to the extent that the space on which you were counting vacua was compact, it would be a topological problem. Now, this guy isn't a topological problem because if you vary the Kähler potential a little bit, so this is also, if W is not zero, okay, critical points, ADS critical points are critical points of the norm of the section. And by varying the real function k, which is just a real function that doesn't satisfy any obvious constraints, you can create pairs of vacua. So the absolute number of vacua is not a topological or deformation invariant number. What doing this is taking the Morse theoretic type of response to that, to say that we're going to weigh critical points with this Morse theoretic sign. Strictly speaking, with a special sign for this case, W equals zero, where this analogy to the Morse theory isn't quite right. Okay, but in any case, you can push through a calculation of the large L asymptotic of this sum, the asymptotic in which this becomes a continuous density using techniques that I hope Frederick will say more about, but which the key step is to argue that as the fluxes become large, so as this becomes large, the typical fluxes that contribute become large, and you're allowed to replace the sum by an integral. Okay, and now you can do this integral by change of variables, and what you get for this asymptotic is in this problem. I guess this is, I'm just going to write it this way. Well, this is density. We didn't integrate it yet. Something just in terms of the local geometry of the Calabi-Yau moduli space. So the Calabi-Yau in this joint Calabi-Yau-Dilaton moduli space is Kähler. There's a Kähler form, omega. And this is the standard curvature 2 form of that metric. And now this is n plus 1 is the total dimension of the space. So n complex moduli and the dilaton. This is the n plus 1 by n plus 1 matrix of curvature 2 form plus this dotted into the unit matrix. We take the n plus 1 determinant and we get a 2n plus 2 form, which is this asymptotic value of this density. Okay, so that's the general result for this local index density of vacua. And it agrees with this. This, of course, is a special case where R is proportional to omega, so you don't quite disentangle the structure, but you can see it in generality. And then you can say things about the asymptotics, which actually fall off better. It's a little than the naive, but not as well as this. And finally, the validity of this form of the corrections of this guy depend on a sort of non-degeneracy. I'm going to get into details which are inappropriate for the talk, but I should just say that as you approach, say, the large complex structure limit in this problem, you can get arbitrarily large corrections and even infinite series of vacua that run off the large complex structure. But, okay, this is an example of a simple distribution which I believe will turn out to have broader validity will be more universal than its derivation. And let's again want to answer questions like, is the vacuum distribution roughly uniform, peaked in any sense? You know, is it finite or infinite? Okay, so that's one example. Now let me just write down another formula of the same type, which is appropriate if you were looking at vacuum stabilized by a single choice of flux. This might be an M theory or another problem. This is also a formula which is appropriate for counting attractor points in the black hole crop. So on the complex structure moduli space, where are black hole attractor points located in the limit that we control the entropy of the black hole, take this asymptotic of it becoming large, then that will go as Z absolute, central charge of the black hole, 2n. If we count the guys which are absolute Z less than some Z star.
The board is not
visible? Let me erase my outline then. And also, what is the time now? 11. Okay, so once I get through this example, will be a good natural point to break, and then we can continue on part three. Okay, so I had the 2B type of distribution. And there's this more simple type of one flux, attractor point, ... thing, which turns out to be a sort of obvious power law, how you would expect the number of black holes with a given entropy to grow with the entropy times the volume form constructed from the Taylor metric. Okay, which is also a very natural guess. If you had to guess, well, what would be the uniform distribution of vacua on Calabi-Yau moduli space? Well, it's got a metric, so you certainly would guess this after a few moments thought. And so this is the correct answer for certain problems, and this is the correct answer for this problem with more flux.
But this is the exponential piece, the actual piece, right?
Yeah, that's right. So that, in this case, is Z star to the... if I ask for Z less than some Z star, I think it's Z star to the 2n plus 2. It's the volume of a sphere in Z space of dimension equal to the number of fluxes that one's varying.
What I mean is this exponential of omega wedge omega star piece, that's missing from... this is this is the black hole entropy, right?
No, I'm controlling the black hole entropy. I'm saying that we get a formula for... Let me write it out. So I just wrote this. Okay, so as Z star goes to infinity and we're counting absolute Z less than or equal to Z star, okay, then the distribution goes as Z star to, I think that, again, this exponent, Frederick can correct me if it's not quite right, some pi's in there. And so the number of black holes with entropy less than this large bound grows as a power law, which is basically the volume in flux space of a sphere, and then is distributed in moduli space. So, the attractor point is distributed in moduli space according to the volume form. Yeah. Okay, so these are two natural sort of distributions. This is what you should call uniform. So it's sort of interesting that this one is not uniform. Now, physically, this has a lot of physics, which I've only just begun to kind of explore. The basic example where this term comes in and becomes important is near a conifold point. So that's a case where the curvature of the Calabi-Yau metric diverges, in fact, positively. And so you can plot, for example, the mirror quintic. We plot a slice through the... So this is this 2D distribution, and this is some real slice through the one complex dimensional moduli space, and the density looks kind of like this. This is off to the large complex structure. This is the conifold point, and the density diverges here. Okay, and there's this other structure. I don't know what it means. Okay, so this divergence is integrable. Okay, so this goes as d mu goes as d2z over absolute z squared log cubed z. Okay, and there's a sort of simple physics for the basic log z, d log z type of behavior here, which is that there's a gauge dual of these flux vacua following originally from Gopu Kumar and Vafa's work, that tells you that in more complicated than this, you know, problem, but sort of, you know, generic, sufficiently complicated situation, including a conical singularity, the flux side, where you have a deformed conical singularity is dual to a theory in 2B with brains wrapped on the resolve side. So in this case, D5 brains wrapped about an S2 you would get by, you know, deforming back to zero and then blowing up, resolving. And so you can alternatively interpret the physics close to this point as the physics of a pure SUN gauge theory, where the N is the Ramon-Ramon flux that you had started with. And that generates a hierarchically small scale. That generates a scale which is e to the minus gauge Kaplan squared of this sort. And now if you have anything like a uniform distribution of these couplings and fluxes, then the fact, and then finally, the Z really controls the scale here. So uniform distributions up here transform into log distributions for this distance to the point Z, which is what you see. But fortunately, okay, the actual sum over fluxes which enters here is such that the sum is still convergent, okay, and the actual number of vacua as you approach this point is finite. Okay, so we come back, I'll again talk more about this finiteness in your theory. And so that's a piece of physics, you know, where you can understand this both ways. And this quantity, okay, in the simpler problem, very general, there are very general arguments. I've spoken to many mathematicians, and there's no satisfying reference, but everybody tells me, you know, they could prove this volume is finite for a Claudial moduli space. Okay, so the number of attractor points for a fixed Z star is finite. Okay, nobody's willing to give me the same assurance for this one. In this basic example, it's finite, but it obviously deserves looking further to, you know, to see. Okay, so again, there are many, many more intricate versions considering the distribution of non-supersymmetric vacua, which you can show really are generic in the sense that we're talking about here.
Even fix scalar moduli.
Yeah, that's right. This is just one part of the problem. So of course it could turn out that you get a certain distance in constructing a vacuum, and then for other reasons you fail at near those points. That's right. There are many ways you could escape a divergence if you found one. Okay. So let's take a break and come back to point three.